The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
The Liars Club, we're a collective of mostly fiction writers. I have not yet been published in fiction yet. So that's why we're called the Liars Club, because most of our members lie for a living. And I'll just briefly tell you who else is in the group besides the authors here. We're also Keith Strunk, Gregory Frost, Kelly Simmons, John McGoran, who writes as D.H. Dublin, Don Lafferty, Murray Jones, Marie Lamba, Sarah Shepard, and Solomon Jones, who's another Philadelphia writer. And we're mostly all in this area. I think we're all in the Philadelphia area. My name's Edward Pettit. I'm a writer. The last time I was up on this stage, I climbed up on it with the Rocky theme playing over the PA system. And I had a boxing robe on with Philly Poe guy on the back, because we had the great Poe debate here. Because I'm the Philly Poe guy, and that's a lot of what I do. I go around and talk about Edgar Allan Poe and Philadelphia Gothic, and that Poe's really a Philadelphia writer, and I have brawling fights with people from other cities who try to claim Poe. I've also been described as a book reviewer, a journalist, a scholar, a film presenter, a professor. I teach writing at LaSalle University. One Swiss newspaper called me un érudit de Philadelphie, which I like a lot. But the favorite thing I've been called is a literary provocateur. I was born in Philly, mostly raised in the Olney section. I'm a member of the Mystery Writers of America, the National Book Critics Circle, and the Philly Liars Club, my favorite appellation that I can put after my name. Although I don't get to lie nearly enough in my career as our panelists, who are all practiced professional liars. So, grain of salt with everything we say here today. Let me introduce everyone. I'll start down at the other end. L.A. Banks. Leslie is a recipient. Please, anytime you feel like applauding, do so. We love that. Leslie is the recipient of the 2008 Essence Magazine Storyteller of the Year Award. She's written more than 40 novels and contributed to 12 novellas, probably written more than I've read. She writes within the genres of romance, women's fiction, crime, suspense, thrillers, and paranormal lore. She is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton undergraduate program, has a master's in fine arts from Temple University, and she's a full-time writer living and working in Philadelphia. Jonathan Mayberry, next to her, is a New York Times best-selling and multiple Bram Stoker award-winning author, whose novels include Ghost Road Blues, Patient Zero, which has been nominated for a Bram Stoker Best Novel Award and is in development for TV right now by Sony Pictures. The Wolfman, which is a novelization of the Universal Pictures film that was just out with Benicio del Toro. And most recently, The Dragon Factory. Jonathan is the author of many award-winning books of nonfiction as well. He also writes a variety of projects for Marvel Comics and is a founding member of the Liars Club. Dennis DeFoya another Philly boy, was born in Philadelphia and dropped out of college to work as a house painter, hospital orderly, and EMT before starting a career in industrial sales. Dope Thief, which was his first novel, was published in May 2009. He's a member of the Mystery Writers of America, the International Thriller Writers, and, of course, the Liars Club. His second novel, The Wolves of Fairmount Park, will be released in June this year, 2010, and he lives in Bucks County. I'll try to be as freewheeling with this as I can, and, you know, I don't want it to be strict question and answer, so feel free to just talk as much as possible. But I thought, as Philadelphia writers, and as most of the people here are probably from Philadelphia, maybe some people interested in writing or pursuing that, if we could just talk about first, how did you first get published? Start with Leslie.
I got started sort of as a fluke. I was trying to answer an Essence magazine short story contest, 10 pages, $2,500. And I had a time when I really needed to do that. And the story got out of control. It started off at 10 pages, went to 75 pages in 3 days. And I gave it to my girlfriends to, you know, get some help cutting it down, and they kept saying, "No, girl, we got to find out what's going to happen next." So I gave up the idea of the contest, and I didn't realize that this contest had me put it in manuscript format. So I had it already in manuscript format, and I would do a chapter when they were at work, and I was looking for a job and all this stuff, and 6 weeks and 600 pages later, I threw it in the closet, but they started mailing it out. And I started getting rejection letters upon rejection letters upon rejection letters. And then, but I got a hit. One of those that they places they mailed it to, which was Arabesque Kensington. Well, they picked me up and they called me and they said they wanted the book. And I was like, "What book?" I didn't even know I had a book. But anyway, that was back in the dark ages, in early 90s.
And what I like best, too, about it is that whole process of how you wrote that book, that kind of, just because I know your story, and that developed a working process where you could produce novels very quickly. And once you did get signed to a publisher, they said, "Write us a novel." And you were just like, "When do you need it? A couple weeks?"
It was, because I didn't know. I didn't come from the formal literary background. So I didn't realize that it took a year or more to write a book, and I was like, "Well, this one took 6 weeks, so I guess that's how long they take. You do 20 pages a day, and you know, and you do the math, and you say, okay, well, times 20 working days in a month, that's 400 pages. I'm good, you know." So I didn't, I learned along the way, but at the time, I didn't know. So sometimes not having enough information is really a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but you haven't slowed down now. I mean, you're still writing faster than anyone in the world.
I don't know, faster than you, though, Jonathan.
She
still has me beat. She's one of those two people. There's two people out there that I think actually write faster than they can type. I'm not sure how that works. But they sit down and pages just magically appear. The other is Kevin Anderson, the science fiction writer who writes, 660,000 word books a year and still has time to goof off. I think he's a mutant. But my entree into the writing world started at Temple University. I was going there for journalism with the intention of becoming the fearless, intrepid, investigative journalist, which I never did. I never actually worked for a newspaper. I started sending out magazine articles in my second year of college and started selling them. And I did that for a lot of years. I wound up teaching at Temple and writing textbooks. And a few years ago, I just took a swing at something that I didn't know would work, which was a nonfiction book on the folklore of vampires and werewolves. And it was very popular. And suddenly, I was known in the horror field for being able to write that stuff. And it was a short jump from there to writing fiction. And once I started writing fiction, my first novel, which was set in Bucks County, I never looked back. Now it's all I do. I write every day. It's the best day job in the world. But it started out by just taking a swing at something while I was in college, writing magazine articles, writing based on personal experience, which for me was martial arts. They say write what you know. That's so true. I wrote about that. And
how many martial arts books did you publish?
I did. Of the
roughly
16 of them are martial arts, yeah. maybe 14.
So you're pretty well established with nonfiction.
Yeah, all nonfiction, and I plus of the 1,200 magazine articles I sold, probably 600 of them were martial arts based. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of writing in that, but now I'm not. Even though I include martial arts elements in my stories and the comics, now I'm writing genre fiction, thrillers, horror. Young adult stuff, and it keeps changing all the time. That's one of the things I love about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dennis, how the heck did you get published?
before I start myself, I do want to mention my favorite bit of arcane knowledge about Jonathan is he's the only writer who's in the Martial Arts Hall of Fame. That's pretty cool.
Right?
I basically just went to work. I left college, let's leave it at that, and held a series of jobs, eventually fell into, industrial sales, and but I always wrote, basically. I wrote at night and in the morning in my basement, I didn't do a lot of I didn't do a lot to get my work out. I did submit a couple stories to online journals, basically, and I'm really glad I did, which is something I tell people who are, you know, thinking about this, but trying to make that jump to being a professional, that getting your work out any way you can is a good thing, because it is a sort of net out there that can catch people. And that's what happened for me. Basically, a woman in California, a producer and screenwriter in California named Corey Stern, saw my work online, and we struck up an online friendship. She said, do you have a novel? At the time, I had two-thirds of a novel. I'd never finished anything. So I finished Dope Thief in 2 weeks and sent it to her. And at that point, she did two things. She introduced me to her manager and to a developmental editor who worked with me on some drafts of the novel. And her manager agreed to represent me, got me a literary agent, and I got published. It was very fast, and I feel like I was visited by angels, basically, in the process. But I would say that the things you can take out of that story are networking and having your work out there in whatever form you can, because there's so many great online venues now and things that are easy. If you're, like me, a working person who doesn't have a lot of time to go through that laborious process of mailing out stories one at a time to the journals and things out there, there's a ton of easy ways people who will take a look at it by email, and you can establish yourself a little bit in that way, so that people can run across you, even if you don't have the time to really devote to getting yourself out to an agent or editor.
Yeah, it leads me to, it's a big multifaceted kind of question about the whole changes in the publishing world that have happened. I mean, I think maybe Leslie and a bit Jonathan did come in, you know, in a more traditional model, especially Leslie, but that's changed considerably now as far as what publishers are wanting to do to promote the books. It seems that they'll sign an author now, but unless they're a multi-million, you know, dollar author, they're not going to really promote it. And how did that – well, I'll start with Dennis's time. And when you got the first book deal and it came out, what changes did you expect to happen to your life? And then, yeah, what's the reality of being an author?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the Terry Gross interview. Basically, you know, you have this idea, I think, that we all do, that you know, you're sort of through the golden door and then everything is different on the other side, and then you're going to be a writer. But the reality is that, you know, 99% of the writers out there, we have day jobs. And so I still have my day job. I still do this every day. You know, one of the things is that there's a judgment that's constantly going on about the commercial value of your work and exploitability of your work, I guess. And for me and a lot of folks like me, we fall into that gray area where our publishers are happy for our success, but they can't do a ton to sort of contribute to that. They give you their name, which carries a lot of weight, especially now when so many folks are self-published and you're trying to, you know, to get time and attention from bloggers and reviewers and bookstores to allow you to come and do signings. So being with a major New York publisher matters. It still matters, but it is a ton of work. You have to, you know, do a lot on your own, and that's why the Liars Club is so important for me, especially, is that it helps me to get out there, get my name out, to share the load and getting out to signings and the things that we do to promote ourselves.
Jonathan? And starting the Liars Club, is this, I mean, I know this, but for the crowd that, you know, talk about a little bit the impetus of beginning the Liars Club to aid in this kind of process now.
Yeah, the way we got that started, it was Gregory Frost, who's a local writer from Swarthmore, teaches at Swarthmore, rather. And he and I have known each other for a while, and we've both, at the time, we were both, you know, just kind of breaking into, you know, mass market. We'd done smaller press, and we're making that step. And we had hit that reality wall of, if you're not a major player in the publishing industry, the publishers generally don't lay a lot of money out to promote you for a couple of reasons. One, you know, they're hit by the economic crash too, and that crash has been hitting the publishing industry for years in waves. And also, it's a safe bet to put money behind someone who has a bigger name, and it's a risk to put it behind someone who isn't. At the same time, they also know that the writer who doesn't have the big name is likely to do a lot to promote their own career. And with the internet and so on, we can. Mm-hmm. So Greg and I got together to talk about how, you know, like what he did that worked for him, what I did that worked for me. And we found that there was about a 30% overlap of the things we both did. And a lot of stuff that he did or I did that weren't the same. So by pooling our resources, we had a bigger picture of what can be done. And as soon as we started, you know, swapping ideas, we said, you know, we got to get more people involved in this because this kind of energy can really help, you know, our end of the writing business. We also found out very quickly that it isn't just the writers who are involved in this. The booksellers need the help from writers. And yesterday I got to meet a bunch of booksellers and also some book salespeople from the major publishers who are working with the booksellers and want to work with the Liars Club to, you know, to do this same thing, to get together, pool ideas, and move everything forward. So we kept bringing people in to the Liars Club until we had an even dozen, which, since we're liars, it actually means 13.
Are we 14 now?
I'm not sure.
That number goes between 13 and 14.
Well, I keep claiming that Charlene Harris and Stephen King are members, so, you know, it's fuzzy math. But the group is interesting because we deliberately selected people who had enough of a positive attitude to be able to keep going forward, to stay optimistic despite the realities of the publishing industry. And we have lots of friends, you know, in the biz who sometimes have lost their faith that anything's going to happen to their career or anything's going to get better. And sometimes they get into negative messaging. We don't. You know, we're very much about positive messaging. And that's what we looked for when building the group. And we were very successful in finding those people who do that. And luckily, they were in all different areas of publishing. So we're seeing how this works, how this plays out with the big names, the big houses, how it plays out with smaller books. Like one of our members, Keith Strunk, has a book from Arcadia, which is one of those little neighborhood books that you see around. They're kind of sepia tone. Well, he has one of those. And that, you know, it's a conventionally published book. It's his entree in. He's pushing that with great enthusiasm. You know, it's not an international bestseller, but it's what he's pushing forward until he gets his next product to push forward, and his enthusiasm is there, and his optimism is there, and that's appealing to people. And so, you know, our whole thing is built around this steamrolling process of positive energy, and when people see that we're having fun, they want to come and play in the same sandbox, because you want to play with people who are having fun. You don't want to hang out with people who are really depressed and down all the time, because nothing good is going to happen out of that.
Yeah.
And around us, a lot of fun stuff's happening. So
it is hard work, but yeah, I mean, doing events is a lot of fun. Although I think we're all very sociable creatures by nature, and that makes it easier for us. And traditionally, is a writer who's someone who goes and sits in a room by themselves and, you know, cranks out their books. And so often enough, writers might not be that sociable. They're the kind of people who like to be alone. So it's a lot tougher, I think, for a lot of authors to go out there and do all this promotion stuff. But it's just absolutely necessary at this point in the game. And Leslie, you've bridged both. You started and you had a much more traditional publishing model where they sent you to events and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, when I first started, like I said, back in the dark ages, which is the early 90s, the publishers were doing tours and that kind of a thing. But again, I came into publishing from a non-traditional place. I was a sales rep. So sit in a room by myself and work, that was like the torture part. The fun part was getting out and going to the conferences and meeting people and getting on the internet. And the first thing that I recall doing was setting up a website that had a chat facility. And I didn't realize that some of the things I was doing, this was before Facebook and a lot of the social networking things were going on. So we had a chat forum, and I would, you know, fall by there like once a week and talk about, you know, where people were in the book and do between the books, because my books were then, at that point, they were coming out every 6 months, and the people didn't want to wait the 6 months till the next book came out. So I was do 20, 30 pages of what happened in between, you know, the last book and this book and stuff. So what started happening was I found that I was helping the publisher along sort of in advance of the wave, and I just got used to doing it. I think that so it wasn't such a rude awakening for me when the market started cutting back, because by the time it did, I was already set up on Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and Amazon Friends, and you do one blog and it goes blah and it hits all those things. And now, mind you, I had a lot of help getting that set up because I am not a technical person, but I knew what I wanted to do. So Don Lafferty, you know, that was one of the benefits of being in the Liars Club, was being able to ask somebody, how do you do this? You know, I want this to happen like this. And somebody would know, like Jonathan.
Don Lafferty is like our social media guru, member of the Liars Club.
The man. Okay. So he definitely is that. And Jonathan and I, when he asked me about this, first of all, we went to Conwell Middle Magnet High School together when we both had afros. And so that was
the 70s were a bad time for hair.
I mean, it was like I had the big Angela Davis, you know, he had it was crazy. So when we got together, it was like, oh, and there's like help across the aisle, you know, for somebody to say, oh, you know, I went through a thing with an agent, and I asked Jonathan, and of course he had somebody that was like fabulous. So there's a lot of sharing. Now, what I will say is, again, for people, I kept my day job for 10, 11 years before I was able to step off, you know, and to write full time. I was very scary raising kids. I was like, no, this is kind of like one of these hit or miss professions. I gotta, you know, take care of, keep the lights on and that kind of a thing. But if you're busy and working, one of the quickest ways I know of, like if you have a manuscript, is to go to the conferences. There are writers' conferences that have editor and agent appointments, and you can sign up to pitch your book. So get your 3-minute elevator pitch down, you know, do it in the mirror, you know, really know what your story is about so that you can sit down and you can sell it. Because the one thing that everybody's been saying here is that, you know, gone are the days where you see SEPTA bus slides with books on there, and, you know, like down in the subway, you see this new book coming out. When's the last time you've seen that? I mean, think about how media has changed. You don't see book commercials on TV. At one point, they were doing that. They don't do that.
But a lot of it is on the web now, and you can find a lot of book trailers on the web.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
You know, the old tradition.
Well, yeah, and
thing.
It's because it's free. They can air it for free there.
Oh,
TV
and
time they'd have to pay for.
You know, like when you see a big display at a Barnes & Noble or Borders or something that has like a full rack of some, they paid for that. The publisher paid for space. And I had a mentor author tell me, like an older person that had been in the business, they said, Leslie, it's like a box of cereal. Just like in, you know, Pathmark or whatever, your book is a product. And so you have to pay for end cap space. You have to pay for special shelving if it's in the front window, just like Kellogg's pays for. I was like, wow, that's so demystifies. I thought I was an author. No. So it really puts it in perspective, you know.
Build your platform, the kind of that you know, that once you publish a book, then you'll have something that, you know, you can put it on already and it'll appeal to people. We mentioned Don Lafferty, and there he is. He shows up. So we're just talking about Don.
Hey.
We're very serious so far, so maybe I'll change it up some questions here and we'll see if we can, you know, lighten up the tone a little bit. I've often found that as much as writers are book people, of course they are and they read a lot, writers are such major TV movie heads, like more than regular people that I meet. I think writers watch more TV and movies than other people do. And so instead of asking, you know, what books or what great works of literature influence you, I often ask what, you know, movies or television shows in particular. Bigfoot and Wild Boy really influenced me a lot when I was a kid. Now I'm growing the beard. So,
But let me throw that to you. I'll start with Dennis. TV show or movie that you think has really influenced you as an artist? I mean, as a someone who now makes up.
I think I loved a ton of the 70s action films. Ed and I the other night were in Jenkintown watching a kind of obscure 70s action film that was a lot of fun called
Hickey and Boggs.
Hickey and Boggs, right? It was shown by our friend Dwayne Swarzynski, a former lawyer. It made me think about a lot of the great films that I'd watched. You know, basically, like usually like 4:30 in the afternoon when I got home from school and should have been doing my homework, but I wasn't. One of them was a film called The Outfit that I just loved with Robert Duvall and Joe Don Baker, Robert Ryan.
Uh-huh.
Great, very little film, and it's about a couple of kind of marginal criminals who end up going up against that 70s version of organized crime, which was weirdly non-ethnic in the movies of the day, like represented by Robert Ryan, this sort of, you know, tentacles of crime everywhere. So they roam around, taking down these gambling houses and floating crap games and stuff like that, and going up against the mob. But what I loved about it, what stuck with me, is that, you know, Robert Duvall and Joe Don Baker were gifted actors, and they had this great kind of Appalachian, you know, presence that, you know, that seemed very authentic. They had this, obviously, had a backstory filled in for themselves. It was based on a novel, Donald Westlake writing
Donald Westlake, who just died of...
Right, as Stark. But they kind of gave it this extra flavor of, you know, of a couple of good old boys and had that rapport together. And that's something I really like. A lot of the people that I write about are kind of... marginal, semi-rural characters. I'm a big fan of. When I was growing up, we used to call them rats. The guys who they weren't like rural, totally rural thugs, but they were, you know, sort of like on the edges of the suburbs, and that's an area I write about, where, you know, the sort of edge of the wild places where these guys are kind of living these marginal lives and, you know, kind of violence and desperation. And so that was something that really stuck in my head for years. I was so glad when it came
out. That's interesting, because a lot of those movies seem to be with character actors in starring roles. And I know from both your novels, your lead characters tend to be people who are, what you say, marginal, and that what you wouldn't think would be the star of a story, but they have their own very deep story to tell. So you get an A for that one. That's a good answer. So, Jonathan?
I've been a kind of an omnivore when it comes to TV and film. I like almost every genre, and I actually have in my head best of lists in almost every genre, because I'm a list maker, and as a writer, that's not something that you need to go to a doctor for. But a lot of, like, probably my earliest influence, the show that I still remember every single episode of, was the original Outer Limits. There wasn't episode of that show that I didn't deconstruct in my mind, because it just presented so many different possibilities, had such great writing, everything from, you know, Demon with a Glass Hand to Soldier to, I mean, there's tons and tons of great stuff there. So I liked shows that were anthology shows that had that sort of thing. Twilight Zone, of course.
Twilight Zone.
And then roll forward to a Night Gallery and those types of shows. I always liked the anthology shows. More recently...
I love the twist, too, don't you?
Yeah, well, always love a twist. Yeah. You know, I'd like throwing something like that at my readers because... Well, and there's a reason for it, by the way. One of the reasons there are twists in so many pieces of writing, especially thriller-type fiction, is because the people who are either watching it or reading it have watched so much of it. They're skilled at watching or reading it. Mm-hmm. And they will have caught up to you by the third act. Yeah. And if they have figured out the end of the book, they may not read the end of the book. Mm-hmm. So you've got to throw them a curve, and it's got to be logical. It can't be, you know, just thought up in the last act, deus ex machina. It actually has to have some logic to it. And if you watch it, if they watch the show again or read the book again, for good writing, you can see where they laid the groundwork for it way back there. And it's usually, I know with my own writing, I'll get to that part of the writing and I'll decide what the twist needs to be. Then I'll go back in my second draft and build that into the story, so it's logically there. But the other thing I like...
Do you think you learn that by watching these shows? Do you think you originally learned that process, too, by watching these shows?
Yeah. I was always deconstructing what I watched, because I always knew I wanted to be a writer. But aside from the anthology shows, the things that I love a lot are ensemble cast shows. Robert Altman's movies. Mm-hmm. Nashville was a brilliant film. More recently, films like Crash, mm-hmm. you know, where you had a lot of different stories running at the same time. That's heavily influenced the way I write. I like writing a lot of storylines. And shows like The Wire, Battlestar Galactica, Band of Brothers, you know, where you have either follow a group of characters through a variety of situations where you have other characters and other storylines coming in, mm-hmm. so we really see how experience warps and changes the dynamic of one character to another and one character's own personality, but also just how one set of events can influence all these different characters. I'm looking forward to watching Treme, the new...
it's good. The first episode was really,
yeah,
really
that,
well
that looks fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's the anthology and the ensemble shows that I gravitate most to. And, you know, there's still other things I like watching. I love X-Files. I love, you know, The Unit and 24 because I like that, you know, solving the crisis of the week sort of thing. But mm-hmm. I do like Flash Forward is a great show. It's one of my favorites right now. It's an anthology and it's an ensemble cast with an intriguing plot, and it's actually getting somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I really, really dig that. And, yes, I am a fan of Lost. And I actually do think I have the ending figured out.
Oh,
we'll
see. Right. That's for another panel conference.
We ought to have a bet.
Yeah, we ought to have a bet.
Leslie, how about you? Were you a TV movie person?
Oh, I was a TV. Okay, let me go back to Dark Shadows, Barnabas Collins, 4 p.m., beating it home from school to sit there and get scared to death. Had to close all the windows and sit there and watch Barnabas Collins. Now,
and Angelique.
Absolutely. You know, so I think that started my paranormal thing. Then my cousins and I, we all lived right in West Philly, so there were two big movie theaters on 52nd Street. It was like the Nixon Theater and then the Locust Theater. That was like at 52nd and Market and 52nd and I want to say like Locust or somewhere like right off there. Anyway, you could go to movies and see like, I don't know, like five flicks for 50 cents. Okay, so we would go all day. And the movie that traumatized me the most was Night of the Living Dead. And I had two levels of trauma. First of all, that was the first time they showed entrails actually coming out of a body, which was like, you know, state-of-the-art technology. And even though the zombies move slow, okay. But for me, I remember we were all cheering because I had my whole family and the whole neighborhood was there. All right, this is a black neighborhood at the time. And this brother was the one, he was just like slicing and dicing and he had all the smarts and everything. 30 seconds before the end of the show, of the movie, they shoot him in the head. All of us were like...
Spoiler alert there, sorry.
No, just say it ain't so. Just say it ain't so. And I swore, you know, we talked about, like, we were really quiet for about two blocks walking home. Everybody was just like, this can't be. My older cousin, I thought he was going to break down and cry, you know? And I told him, I was like, Trace, I promise you, if I ever, ever, ever make a movie or I ever write, I'm going to make the black guy make it to the end. He's going to get the girl. He's going to do all this stuff. And we laugh. Well, we laugh about it now because at that point, I didn't have any aspirations to be a writer. But that was the first thing I did. I'm like, okay, dude is going to get the girl. He's going to be the baddest mother in the valley. We're going to have all this stuff. We'll have, you know, creatures. We're going to have hell. We're going to have everything. But he's just going to make it on through. You know? That was my payback for Night of the Living Dead 1, all right? Now, as far as the vampire, you know, again, going back to the oldies but goodies, you know, Frank Langella's version of Dracula, I think, was the sexiest one because that was the first time I really saw that part of it in the movies because dude is standing there outside the woman's window and all he is doing is standing there and giving her the eye and girlfriend starts like coming out of her clothes. I'm like, that's power. He's just standing there and she's, oh, okay, I know how to do this. Anyway, so those are some of my influences.
And they're all there in your books, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, all that kind of stuff. Creature Double Feature.
Oh, yeah.
To this day, I still watch cheesy sci-fi flicks on the sci-fi channel whenever I can. I mean, my daughter, she's like, Mom, Mega Shark, come on. mega piranhas. I'm not watching this with you. And I'm all like, come on, this is going to be good. This is going to be off the chain. And so you cannot convince a 19-year-old to, you know, relive your childhood with you. But anyway.
And somebody's got to give Anthony Sabato Jr. and Casper Van Dien
work. Yeah, yeah, you know. So,
thank God for sci-fi.
I love all that stuff. The crazier, the better.
I'll do one more question, and then we'll try to do these quick answers if we can, and then we'll open it up questions from the audience. If you could live inside any book, like Gumby, if you could live inside of any book, what's the first book you would choose? What book do you want to go and live in that world?
Oh, man, I could not even...
Nobody ever answered that one?
I got one.
Go ahead.
It actually would be I Am Legend.
I'm
serious.
Because you could kill everybody.
Well,
you could beat them all up.
Grant, I'd be a little tougher than the character in the book, but I actually think I could make peace with the new vampire culture that rises up. If you ever read the book, by the way, it's different than the movie. They're vampires, not ghouls, not zombies, mm-hmm. and not in the last version, the Will Smith version. They were all nude Ted Danson monster thingies, which I don't quite get, but that's creepy by itself. But I think I could have made peace with the new vampire culture that rose up. And you know, granted, I would have been the outsider, but I would like to have seen what it would be like to build an entirely new civilization on the ruins of the old. That would fascinate me.
Actually, the last book I was reading, I just read it yesterday because I'm teaching it to my class on Monday. I had them all read it.
Well, I met Matheson when I was a teenager. Yeah. He gave me a copy of that.
You should come in this week. Can you come in this week to the class? Sorry, guys. I'm going to set an appointment here. Can you come in this week? Well, we'll talk about it. Maybe we could talk about that.
Yeah. And that book's always fascinated me. So that would be my number one choice.
That's grim.
I got one.
Go ahead.
Okay. Tina McElroy answers, The Hand I Fan With. It's a paranormal, and it's about basically a woman who has this beautiful home down in Gullah Country, and she's like around 50 years old, and she's divorced, and she conjures up this fine man. And nobody can see him but her, but the things this man does, I'm like, oh yeah, and they call him Herman, but it's a play on words, her man. So it's sort of like a conjure story, you know, Gullah Country kind of a thing. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I could do that.
Dan, you have one?
This is a tough one for me because the things I love are not typically worlds I would like to inhabit.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be in your novel or I wouldn't want to be in any of these novels right here. That's not a world I want to deal with. I like reading about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the books like I love, like Madison Smart Bell's Save Me, Joe Louis. Just amusing. A great book. Amazing. It's one of those books that I love because it's the kind of thing I aspire to do, where it's driven by plot and action, but it's beautiful writing. It's amazing craft at work. But it's a pretty terrifying world. But it's a couple of violent, you know, losers who are get themselves into worse and worse trouble until they end up trying to kill each other. So I don't know if I really want to live in that world, but I sure admire the writing. Yeah, I think I'd try, you know, if I could think about it long enough, I'd pick something where everyone's really witty and rich and live in that world.
So. All righty. Why don't we open it up for questions? Anybody have a question? What's that? Yeah. Right over here. There's a microphone right there next to you.
Oh, yeah, Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon.
L.A. Banks. I have a question. How do you come up with the layers and underlayers to your vampire books, to the hell that you put everybody through? How do you come up with that? And what is your background as a, are you a Christian? Are you like, how does that enter into the world of your writing?
Okay. I have layers in my head. So that, you know, partially being insane helps, but the layers of hell, I really kind of lifted from Dante's Inferno, okay? And I just put some extra top spin on there because I watched all the werewolf and vampire and zombie and all those movies. So I had to have a place for each category of monster that I grew up watching as a kid. And that's, so I'm like, okay, Dante's Inferno, we'll just work some layers in here. So that's sort of where I came from. Now, I'm a Christian, Episcopalian, but I love world religion. So when I'm doing my research, you know, I will sit down with a Quran, a Torah, you know, a Bible, you know, and some of the mythology that I kind of pulled together, it doesn't all come from the Christian background. Like Lilith comes out of, you know, the Jewish tradition. So, and when I found out about, I'm like, Adam has a first wife? Whoa! That, okay, stop right there, you know. So it was just, I guess the layers come from multiple interests. Like, you know, Jonathan said, if you're an omnivore of reading and you love different kinds of movies and TV shows, and I have an eclectic, you know, from Celine Dion to DMX on my iPod. Okay, so, I mean, really, it's a little, you know, so that's where the layers come from.
Anybody else? Right here. Wait for a microphone.
What does the Liars Club do?
Events like this, events at libraries, events at bookstores, especially independent bookstores, we like to promote a lot, and we'll meet. And because we can meet en masse, with several authors, those readers from each of those authors can come and kind of cross-pollinate, you know, readership.
Yeah, we. Over the last couple of years, we've had a couple of different campaigns. One campaign was Liars Tell the Truth About Independent Bookstores. And since they got really slammed by the economic downturn, mm-hmm. we were throwing parties, not to say, oh, you know, poor store, to come and help them, keep them out of the gutter. That's negative messaging. We said, hey, independent bookstore, they love books, you love books, let's have a party.
Come out, yeah.
And so people would come in, and we'd celebrate independent bookstores. And this year we've been doing the same thing with libraries. You know, they have so many resources that people don't know about. So we want to get people physically into a library so they can get to see all that a library has to offer. And, you know, God knows, as writers, we love libraries and bookstores because that's where the books live. And we're also going to be doing some writing classes and workshops and a bunch of other stuff. We're even considering doing an anthology of short stories. So
we've kicked around the idea of a conference that we would hold.
Probably do a writer's conference.
People would come and...
Right now, we don't know all that we do because we keep coming up with new ideas. And as long as we have ideas that are going to be fun for everyone, we're going to keep churning them out there. And also, you know, we still network together, too, and that's still an element of what we're doing. And we'll be doing that in partnership with booksellers, salesmen from book companies, and anyone else who wants to participate in the fun of getting more books on the shelves and more books in the hands of people who love books.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a reader of, you know, paranormal fiction, you know, being a Liars, as a Liars Club, our message to readers is, well, you should try a crime fiction novelist or a science fiction novelist. That's or right. somebody else mm-hmm. in the group. And if you're a writer, our message is, network with each other. I mean, Leslie mentioned to go to conferences to maybe pitch something to an agent, but go to conferences to meet other writers and form your connections and make friends and make your own groups. Not only support yourselves as writers and as artists helping each other with your art, but what you're going to do with that art afterwards and how you're going to sell it and how you're going to market it and publicize it. Because it's up to you.
Yeah, certainly with readers, too. We love, you know, to see readers form groups to discuss books.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost a shame when somebody reads a good book and says, wow, that's really great, and they don't talk about it with anyone. You know, we want people to you know, if they read a good book, talk about it with other people, online or in person. You know, say, hey, wow, I read something. This really spoke to me. Somebody else, you know, could have an experience where the book spoke to them, but in a different way. When you start comparing notes, you start seeing all the different facets of a book. Sometimes you'll come up with wonderful subtext that the writers didn't know they put in there. And we like hearing about that. You know, it's like, oh, really? That was a metaphor in that book? In my book? Really? Tell me. But no, everyone who loves books, we want to be partnered with them in some way.
Another question out here? Ready?
Mayberry, I think you said earlier that you studied some type of martial art.
Mm-hmm.
What particular style of martial art is it that you studied?
I have an A3 black belt in Shinoa Ryu Jiu-Jitsu, which is a traditional Japanese style. It's about 800 years old.
Yeah.
And also, I've been practicing Kenjutsu for nearly as long, which is over 40 years now. And I taught martial arts history at Temple University for 14 years.
My favorite question for Jonathan was always, how many slow zombies could you take out? And his answer was always indefinite. because they're slow. And Fast Zombies, he had a real answer, and number was like 4 or something like that.
Well,
you knew.
It depends on how big the room is and whether there are people who are slower than me that I can throw in their path.
It's a question over here.
I'm not living in your books.
I have a little bit of a two-part question. The first question is, would you advise a first-time author to go the self-publishing route, or should they try for a publishing house? And the second part of the question is, do you think, I kind of understand that the genres are directed towards a lot of vampire-style writing and different paranormal styles. Do you think there's a market for more artistic poetry, catharsis, that type of genre?
Okay.
Or is it pretty much just open to, you know, public interpretation like most artists?
Okay, let me start with the first part of the question. I always say, you know, give it your best shot trying to get picked up if you can, because that will provide you an advance. They will, you know, give you an advance. It's easier to get into bookstores than if you are self-published, because if you're like with St. Martin's Press or, you know, one of the larger presses, you're not going to have any, like their sales force is going to go to the chain stores and make sure that you're there. So that's why you see certain books in every store, or it's in Walmart and Kmart and whatever. The more books that are out on the shelf means you're doing more sales. Whereas when you have to self-publish, you are a small business. Not only do you have to physically get those books into various independent booksellers' hands, you got to collect your money. And so that's the part. So if you have to really ask yourself, how much can I deal with? You know, can I deal with living with boxes in my kitchen stacked up 5,000 deep? And it's nothing wrong with it. I mean, there are people like Omar Tyree and Karen Quinones Miller, and there's a lot of people in Philadelphia especially that started off, they were independent, you know, they self-published, sold like 15 to 20,000 copies on their own, and then went into a publisher and got picked up and walked away with a six-figure contract. But to do that, they were hustling. I mean, it was a serious hustle. They did everything. They had to make sure that, you know, it was edited. They had to make sure that they really had a good cover on there, get their own ISBN number, copyright, blah, blah, blah. And then they were the ones that, like I said, they had to go pick up those cases, and they were at every festival moving their product and, you know, shaking down some of the bookstores when they didn't get their money when they were supposed to. So you have to kind of answer that question for yourself. I couldn't do it at the time because I had small children at home and I had a day job. So I did not have that kind of energy. Now, the second question, I don't really know about poetry and cathartic kind of work. I know that right now what's hot is the genre work. Poetry, somebody else might want to speak to that.
Yeah, there are only two people in the country who are making a full-time living as poets, as from their poetry publishing, which is Maya Angelou and Billy Collins. Everyone else is making a living from lecturing or teaching or something. Poetry is a very hard sell in the United States. More than 90% of the books of poetry that are in print are self-published. So if you're going to try to get a book of poetry published, it is actually more likely to be successful in self-publishing. It's one of the few areas mm-hmm. where self-publishing is also respected. Understand the lack of respect for self-publishing that exists in certain areas comes from the conventional publishing world. Since they make no money off of self-published books, they not only do not support it, they campaign against it. And even good self-published books get painted with the same brush, because everyone in conventional publishing does not like those books. It's not helping the industry thrive. So there's going to be that resistance there. Doesn't mean the books are bad. It just means that they're not going to get support. Mm-hmm. A lot of bookstores, you know, if a bookstore is carrying a lot of self-published books, some of the book publishers may not give them the same incentives that they would normally give, and there are always incentives going forth, back and forth with bookstores. If they see that they're supporting a lot of books that are not making the industry money, they're going to say, well, if you're not supporting us fully, why should we support you? and it trickles down to the writer. That said, there is a movement within self-publishing to create micro-presses. Somebody will go and form an LLC to publish books. That person is not publishing their own books. They're publishing, that could be your brother-in-law. He forms an LLC, publishes your book. Because if it's your publishing company and your name on it, they're going to look at it as if it's self-published. But if a small business is formed by someone else and publishes your book, it actually gives your book a shot to be respected, reviewed, and placed on shelves. May not guarantee it, but it's the only way in which it's going to get a shot. And what's happened is some of these micro-presses are gaining traction and becoming successful publishing companies. Permuted Press is a good example. It's a horror imprint. Started off, a guy formed it to publish the horror stories of some friends of his. Now, every book that he publishes is then picked up by Pocket Books after it's had a run with him, which means these guys are getting a huge boost up now to conventional publishing. Mm-hmm. So that would be the safest route to go. But I still think, and I'm sure the others would agree, if you have a book that fits any of the successful genres out there, try the conventional route first.
Yeah. Right. Oh. And you should try to the point where, I mean, if you don't have 30 rejection letters, then you probably haven't tried hard enough. Because successful authors have folders full of rejection
letters. J.K. Rowling, 117 rejections for Harry Potter. Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, 333. That's the most and that book is the most successful single novel in the history of language. And it was rejected 333 times.
I think, too, the good news is that there are a million venues now for work.
Right.
So you don't have to stop at the rejection letter. You can, as I was saying before, you can get stuff onto websites. Right. You can get stuff out to, you know, to people who are buying short stories. There are magazines. There are a million different ways to get your name out. You can have a blog with your own stuff on it. So it doesn't keep you from expressing yourself or finding a community of writers.
Oh, and wait, and speaking of the blogs, that's how Zane made a mint. She started off, she didn't have a book. She started off doing episodes online of the Sex Chronicles. Right. And so it was like a blog of her book. And people were like, oh, they were waiting on the next. And she built a mailing list so that when the book came out, when she self-published the first book, boom, she had 2 million people that went right into the pipeline. There's also a way to tie in. Like if you've got poetry, say 20, 30 pieces of poetry, but you're also trying to write a book and you're dealing with that, make it an opening for every chapter. So do the piece of poetry as chapter openers. I had some old poetry from high school that I had to resurrect because I had a spoken word artist that's my vampire huntress. So whenever Damali does a spoken word, I'm like, wait, let me go. And I would pull up some old crying stuff I had about some man or whatever. And that would be her spoken word piece. So you don't have to, don't say, oh, well, I only have poetry. Well, I only have this. You can blend that work up together.
Great. Well, I have a quick one-word answer. Well, it's a one-phrase answer from each of you, and then we'll wrap it up. The last book you were reading, Dan?
The last book I read?
Yes, that you were reading.
The last book I read that I'm just finishing is David Grand's book of New Yorker pieces, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. It's amazing, beautiful, you know, great stories that are also good fodder for the crime fiction writer.
The last one I read was Rain Gods by James Lee Burke, beautifully written book in a beautiful series of literary crime novels.
I'm so weird. The body restoration plan. I was reading, when I'm writing, I can't read other work. So I do like self-help stuff in between. It's like chemical stuff and toxic stuff in the body, doing like cleanses.
Our authors will be signing books upstairs in the main lobby. I want to thank everybody for coming to our event and for coming to the whole book festival this year in Philadelphia. I think it's important that the Philadelphia Library has these events and brings readers out en masse to meet authors. And please, big hand for our authors today.
Thank you. Oh, one more question.
Wait, do we have?
You know what? We have to go.
It's going to go off.
Well then.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.